My name is, the operator said, is Robert Borsage. I'm director of the Institute for America's Future. And today, I'm pleased that Kate Gordon and Senator Sherrod Brown are joining to release a report entitled "The Green Industrial Revolution and the United States, Will the U.S. Be a Leader or a Luddite?" Today we will hear from Kate and from Senator Brown and then open for questions. The report is a joint project of the Apollo Alliance, part of the Blue-Green Alliance, of the Institute for America's Future, and of the Center for American Progress. It is co-authored by myself, Kate Gordon, and Eric Pugh. It's available online at www.ourfuture.org/green revolution. No space between those two words. The report assesses the growing competition for leadership in the renewable energy and green industrial revolution. It outlines the imperative of sustaining a leading role for the United States and the threats to that lead from both competition abroad and destructive policies here at home. It proposes a strategy that builds on American strengths, a regional approach with proactive national policies to provide a sensible way forward. I'm going to talk shortly about the first two points. One is the green industrial revolution is already underway. The growing commitment to renewable energy and energy efficiency is already informing governmental, corporate, and private decisions. You know, we give a lot of attention to the bitter battles over Keystone or climate change, and too little is paid to this extraordinary transformation that's already gaining momentum. This clean energy revolution will alter over the next decades almost everything: where we live, how we travel, how we produce and distribute energy. It will be the source of expanding global markets, of innovation and dynamism, generating millions of new jobs, everything from construction workers installing rooftop solar panels to scientists on the cutting edge of technology. This is already beginning. Across the globe, investments in renewable energy power plants were higher than fossil fuel power plants in 2012. The countries that lead this revolution will benefit not only because they address climate change, but because they will capture a lead in the new markets that must sweep the world. For the United States to rebuild its broad middle class, leading in this area will be essential. In this country, renewable energy capacity doubled between 2009 and 2012. Advanced energy industries grew faster than the overall economy over the past decade. Wind and solar energy policies have dropped dramatically, making them more competitive with traditional sources. The U.S. installed more power capacity from wind power in 2012 than from any other source. But we will have to act to sustain our leadership. We are a leader in advanced energy innovation, but we have serious rivals, particularly in Germany and in China. Both countries have made a clean energy transition central to their overall economic development strategies. China's new five-year plan, for example, designates clean energy technology, alternative energy, and clean energy vehicles as, quote, strategic emerging industries that it will seek to dominate. It already has the largest renewable energy capacity in the world. Here in this country, the president's climate action plan has set clear goals, but U.S. policies have consistently been the source of partisan division and fierce resistance from entrenched interests. Funding for new energy research and development is getting squeezed in our unending federal budget conflicts. Key initiatives, particularly the production tax credit that is vital to the windmill industry, are slated to expire by the end of this year. At the state level, the American Legislative Exchange Council and its allies are pushing to repeal or weaken renewable portfolio standards, vital for creating the a market for renewable energy. This kind of stop and start intermittent policies and initiatives gets in the way of private investment, and it endangers emerging industries. Constrictive funding in R&D puts at risk our edge in technology and innovation. So we need a clear commitment and a serious strategy. And what the report outlines is a strategy that builds on American strengths, particularly its strength in innovation, its regional diversity, and its bottom-up approach to economic development. To talk about that, let me introduce Kate Gordon. Kate is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. She is vice president and director of the Energy and Climate Program at Next Generation, and she's a board member of the Apollo Alliance. Kate?
Thank you so much, Bob, and you covered some great ground. I'll just add a bit to it. So Bob talked a lot about the competitiveness imperative of the U.S. jumping on and leading the clean energy transformation. We also have a climate imperative to do that. We know from a recent UN report on climate that 97% of scientists believe the Earth is warming and human behavior is the cause. As the financial sector folks I like to work with say, if 97% of your advisors say something is probably true, you should pay attention to it. But the fact that human behavior is the cause also means that we are the solution. We have a huge opportunity to be global leaders in clean energy innovation and production and construction and installation. And we know, and Bob pointed out, American businesses and workers are already making this happen. We're already seeing amazing projects happening at the local level. We're seeing private and capital investment up in renewable energy more than 600% since 2004. At least $2.5 trillion of investment in the broader global clean energy market is projected over the next decade. We just saw in a New York Times article last week that global companies, including oil companies, are starting to incorporate potential long-term climate and carbon policy into their own internal budget projections. Businesses are paying attention to this shift. And we in the United States have a huge opportunity to lead, as we do in most transformations and most industrial revolutions. We have an opportunity to lead with innovation and entrepreneurship. However, to lead in this space, to truly lead in this space, we need a policy framework that supports those businesses and those workers. We need a policy framework that supports local leaders who are really at the forefront of energy transformation and climate response. The American Recovery and Investment Act back in 2009 really was a great step toward this. Put down some very strong local initiatives, helped support regional innovation, and helped support a doubling of renewable energy capacity in the U.S. between 2009 and 2012. That program, however, was time limited, and most of the programs that we have in place for clean energy in this country, unlike in China and Germany and other countries, most of ours are time limited. I just today saw a report on quarter three job growth in 2013 in the clean energy sector showing this. The solar industry, which where the investment tax credit is still in place, won't expire until the end of 2016, had strong growth in 2013. But in the wind sector, where the production tax credit is operating under a one-year extension that's very politically vulnerable, those jobs are in decline. Those projects are in decline. These industries depend on policy consistency to help them create innovation and help put new projects in place for local workers and for local communities. One last thing that we do know about the U.S., we know that our businesses and our workers can lead. We also know leadership comes from the local level. If you look at the clean tech revolution, we saw regional innovation, Silicon Valley, the Research Triangle Park. We've seen regional innovation on clean energy out of the Senator's home state of Ohio, Toledo, transforming its window industry into a solar industry. Regions lead in this sphere as they do in general in the United States. It's a major competitive advantage we have over countries like China that have top-down policies. The U.S. needs a set of national policies that provide a framework for that regional action, a national set of policies that evens the playing field between carbon-intensive industries and low-carbon industries, that allows for the growth of clean energy, that gives certainty and stability to alternative fuels and alternative energy, and that supports clean energy manufacturing, because that is the backbone of this sector. In the paper, we make a strong case that the Department of Commerce, not traditionally one of the main industry departments involved in energy and climate, become a lead agency for this energy transformation. The Department of Commerce has in place a set of a system that allows for support to regional economic development agencies, that's a local state, local economic development project. The Department of Commerce also is in a unique position in terms of climate change and being able to forecast out economic risks from climate, because it has the NOAA satellite system and can look at climate weather patterns. those two things combined, the very big picture from the satellites and the very granular look at economic development, are key to our becoming leaders in this space. We think the Department of Commerce could step up with increased capacity, could step up and be a central department, ensuring that projects out of the other departments work together to support regional economic development plans on clean energy that will help us consolidate our leadership and lead the green industrial revolution. I'm going to leave it there and go back to Bob to introduce one of my heroes, Senator Sherrod Brown.
Thank you, Kate. And now let me introduce Senator Brown from Ohio. As most of you know, Senator Brown's been a tireless champion of working families across the country and in his own state. He has led in the Senate the effort to create a coherent manufacturing and trade strategy for the country, one that will help rebuild good jobs here at home and is essential if we are going to rebuild a broad middle class. That mission led him early on to see the potential of the green industrial revolution and the imperative of renewable energy and the benefits that would come to the U.S. if we led in this area. And so he has been at the center of policymaking, trying to forward and to support the emergence of this key industry. It's a pleasure to introduce Senator Sherrod Brown.
Bob, thank you. Thank you for your really important work and long-time commitment at the Institute for America's Future. And Kate, thanks for the work you do and your kind words, the work you do as a senior fellow at CAP. Manufacturing, as we know, and certainly people on this call know this, that the manufacturing created a middle class in places not just in Ohio but across this country. It strengthens communities. It led to a nation of innovators and builders. It's why we led the world in so many ways for so many years and have led the world. Manufacturing jobs have a larger multiplier effect than any other part of our economy. For every dollar spent in manufacturing, another $1.48 is added to our economy. Ohio has the fifth highest, we're the third leading manufacturing state, we have the fifth highest number of clean energy jobs in the nation. Some 29,000 of those jobs are in manufacturing itself. Ohio's clean energy economy adds jobs at a faster rate than the state's overall economy, and this is true most places nationally. The clean economy increased by 8.5% from 07 to 2010, while Ohio's economy as a whole lost some 350,000 jobs over the same period, roughly a decrease of 6.1%. The report that is being released today shows we can create jobs, we can revitalize our manufacturing base by investing in the clean energy economy and strengthening valuable energy programs such as renewable energy standards and federal tax credits for wind and solar. Our competitors are taking big steps in advanced energy. China now has the largest renewable energy capacity in the world. We know that trade with China poses huge challenges and opportunities for us. The solar case illustrates this, with U.S. producers having mixed views on challenging China's use of subsidies to prop up its solar industry. The administration's been aggressive in responding to the challenge of Chinese subsidies. I'd argue that trade enforcement is one tool that must be part of a clean energy manufacturing strategy. But trade enforcement, obviously and surely, is not enough. That's why Senator Blunt, a Republican from Missouri, and I introduced the bipartisan Revitalize American Manufacturing and Innovation Act of 2013. It would create a national network for manufacturing innovation to position the U.S. as the world's leader in advanced manufacturing. We do better when we work together, and a network for manufacturing innovation would establish the kind of public-private partnership, giving small businesses and industry leaders and research institutions and labor unions the tools they need to compete on a global scale. These regional industry-led hubs will leverage local expertise, sort of like a teaching hospital in some sense, and will hopefully create thousands of high-paying, high-tech manufacturing jobs for next generation workers. In August, the first ever National Additive Manufacturing Innovation Institute, now called America Makes, opened in Youngstown, Ohio. The president mentioned in his State of the Union early in 2013. The hub's becoming a national model for tying together manufacturing supply chains with product development. Our workers have the drive and the creative thinking and the determination to out-innovate the rest of the world. We just need to make sure they have the tools and resources to do that. Investing in clean energy manufacturing is a step in that direction. And thanks,
Senator.
Thanks, Bob.
And thank you, Senator. Thank you, Kate. We're waiting for the questions to line up. I just want to emphasize the kind of scope of the policy recommendations, which we will be entertaining discussions with people in the Commerce Department. We think this offers an interesting new way to push forward on a sensible plan for the country of this area.
First question comes from Amy Harder. Amy, the floor is yours.
Hello, thank you for holding this call. This question is for Senator Brown. I wanted to ask you about how you think natural gas fits into this equation. I know Ohio is considering developing the Utica Shale. How did that fit into the manufacturing industry in Ohio and around the country?
I think natural gas is obviously a cleaner energy. It's not solar or wind, but it's cleaner than coal production. It's competitively priced. The price of natural gas is settled in, I believe, around $4 CCF, I believe, and most manufacturers predict it will stay between $4 and $5 for some time in the future. It's made a difference in steel production in Ohio, the drilling for natural gas and oil. It domestically has led to a major steel investment, a company called V&M Star in Youngstown, and Wheatland Steel and I believe Warren in Trumbull, and expansion of U.S. Steel in Lorain, Ohio. We're seeing that other places around the country. It's part of an energy picture that will make us more energy efficient as a nation, will make us more energy independent, and will obviously help to drive the cost down for manufacturing. We shouldn't stop these investments it's clear that as this report shows, that we continue to invest in all kinds of clean energy, in solar and wind. We're seeing a lot of that investment in Ohio. I think natural gas plays into that too.
And Amy, if I can just jump in as Kate on this, I think this underscores why we took a regional approach in this paper and why we think that's so important. I once heard Henry Waxman make the comment that energy is inherently regional, and I think that's right. Natural gas development is actually obviously happening in very particular parts of the country and being moved around the country in particular ways, potentially exported, but there are still parts of our country that are importing natural gas from overseas. For a long time, New England has imported natural gas from Yemen. So these markets are not, it's not always as easy to just move things around as we think. We should be looking at natural resources in the different regions of the country and where those regions have a competitive advantage in producing that energy, manufacturing those systems, and potentially exporting it outside their borders. One thing we talk about in this paper, we refer back to an earlier Center for American Progress and Next Generation, my current employer paper, that looks at each region of the country and actually really pulls apart what are the economic development opportunities in those regions and makes the point that we need a diversified system of energy that doesn't just depend on one bonanza fuel, but really looks across at what we're good at in different regions of the country and develops that out as an economic development strategy, but also an energy strategy.
The next question comes from John Funk. John, the floor is yours.
Okay. One thing that the senator didn't mention is that natural gas has driven down the price of electricity on the wholesale market, and that has made it more difficult for wind and solar to compete, at least to compete in a free market. I'd like him to address that issue, that natural gas, I know it's helped the steel mills, but it's also made electricity very, very cheap. That's actually hurt some of the Ohio utilities.
Thanks, John. A couple of things. That underscores to me the importance of renewables, of renewable energy standards, renewable portfolio standards, and the legislature I know is considering repeal. Most responsible people oppose that in the business world and in consumer advocates and others. I also think you look at this long term, and we know what's happened with energy prices, how volatile they can be, and why, while a number of people think natural gas prices are going to stay at $4 or $5, they aren't going to stay there forever. And that's the importance of investment in solar and wind, and not to be caught short the next time prices spike, the next time oil prices spike, the next time natural gas prices go up. I remember talking to a plastics manufacturer not far in my old house district, not far from where I lived and or live, and he was, I believe in those times, at that time natural gas was $11 and $12. I mean, I'm not alarmist. I don't expect that anytime soon, but I also think in energy you can't pivot on a dime, and you need these investments now, as the Chinese are doing and others. Again, you know, we want to declare, you know, we want to be energy independent, but we don't want to now become dependent on energy production, on solar and wind manufacturing coming from elsewhere. There's just simply no reason we shouldn't be doing it and incentivizing it in this country now.
It's interesting that, this is Bob Borsage, there's a recent report from the Department of Energy that suggests that the country's wind farms are already broadly competitive with fossil fuels, even in this era of inexpensive shale gas. And if you don't believe the Department of Energy, UBS and Citigroup are arguing to investors that investments in solar make a lot of sense, because they believe that just on economic grounds alone, across Europe, you're going to see virtually every family home and every commercial rooftop with solar systems by the end of the decade. So the growth of these systems and the price drop on solar and wind is making it, it more and more competitive, even in this era of the natural gas revolution.
Next question comes from Lucy May. Lucy, the floor is yours.
Hi, my apologies. I have a question for the senator that's off topic, and that is, Senator Brown, do you think a deal can be reached on the farm bill before Friday?
I'm very hopeful that there can be. I speak with Senator Stabenow every couple of days. I spoke to other senior members of the conference committee on the Senate side today, and spoke with Congressman Fudge, the only other Ohioan on the Farm Bill conference committee. I think we're very close on the nutrition title. We're very close on the commodities title, which are the two most controversial. We've mostly come to agreement on the energy and rural development titles. So I'm very optimistic. I think it's imperative that we do this now. One out of seven jobs in Ohio is related to food and to agriculture. I know what this means. A prosperous farm economy matters everywhere in our state. One of the provisions in this bill really plays into this discussion today with biomass and what we can do with the kind of combination and the synergism of manufacturing and agriculture together. So I'm very hopeful we do it this week, and we can, you know, the important thing for Ohio farmers is that they need certainty, and if we go through the end of the year, that certainty, that uncertainty is injected into their planning decisions more, planting and planning decisions more. That's why it's important we do it this week or next week. Yeah, I can take one more question if it's not for me. If it's from either Ms. Gordon or Mr. Borsage, fine, but I've got to go and vote. But I need to do one more question. I apologize.
Follow-up question comes from Kate Lane. Kate, the floor is yours.
Hi. The production tax credit and for solar and wind was mentioned, but Senator Brown, you used to work, or you've introduced bills in other Congresses where the 48C manufacturing, clean energy manufacturing tax credit, you tried to expand it. You haven't done that so much more recently, and I was wondering if you're interested in expanding that program or have any plans there or any thoughts on the program.
Yeah, we're still supporting 48C and working with Senator Stabenow. It's actually her legislation. I've been involved with her on it. We will try to move forward on that with as tax extenders if we have to. We were certainly looking at that as part of major tax reform. Major tax reform looks less likely today than it might have 6 months ago. So we plan to move forward on it if we possibly can.
Bill, the floor is yours.
This report suggests that there's not a
contradiction between clean energy and manufacturing. Do you feel that the president's climate initiatives through the EPA, which have been attacked as being job killers, might they actually be an additional incentive to fuel more green manufacturing and create jobs?
I'll tackle that one first. You know, you're right that historically there has often been tension between environmental interests and manufacturing interests. Manufacturing is often carbon intensive and obviously the subject of a lot of regulation on the environmental side. However, I think a couple things are happening. First, over the last 10 to 20 years, the big manufacturers in the United States, because of just global competitiveness, have done an extremely impressive job of getting efficiency and energy efficiency down in their own factories. So we've seen massive energy efficiency improvements in the steel industry, in the pulp and paper industry, in the chemical industry. They really have brought down their energy intensity quite dramatically. And some of that has been just pure competitiveness, and some of it has been regulation. So I think that's important. I think we're operating at pretty high efficiency because of the global market in our manufacturing sector. The second thing I would say is that the cleaner the energy coming into the factories using energy, the better their energy. So there's a real synergy between cleaning up or, making less carbon intensive the overall United States energy system and having those manufacturing companies, which do tend to be fairly energy intensive, be able to use clean and affordable and consistent and not variable forms of energy, particularly local energy, which does tend to be cheaper. So that's another piece. A third piece is, of course, that manufacturing is a big chunk of the clean energy system. Back during the Recovery Act, it was about, and the first time the Bureau of Labor Statistics started counting green jobs, it was about 26% of all jobs created in the clean energy sectors were in manufacturing. It's down to about 15. It's down only because the construction industry has massively increased its share, but manufacturing is still a big chunk of the jobs that are created because we're essentially, innovating and making these systems. And that's the final point I'd make is that, and we say in the report, is where we have an advantage in manufacturing in the United States is in innovative and advanced manufacturing. We've become very efficient in manufacturing. We've become efficient in terms of energy. We've become very skilled. We have an advantage in these new emerging innovative systems to really design, manufacture, and export this stuff. So I think on balance, this is a very, very positive story for the manufacturing industry. Absolutely, there will be some growing pains as some of the regulations get put in place, and some of these companies have to kind of innovate internally to become even more efficient. But on balance, these sets of industries could be the competitive edge that the U.S. manufacturing sector has been looking for. So I think it's a very positive story on balance.
This question comes from Zaya Poole. Zaya, the floor is yours.
Yes. Wanted to ask Kate, conservatives often, whenever you talk about government involvement in green energy, Solyndra always comes up. And I wanted to get your opinion on whether, A, was in retrospect, the government investment in Solyndra a mistake? And if it wasn't a mistake, then what are the lessons that you learn that we should be learning from that whole experience?
Thanks for the question. So just as reference for folks on the call who probably remember this well, the Loan Guarantee Act out of the Department of Energy was part of the Reinvestment and Recovery Act. What loan guarantee programs do in general is to give a government guarantee to private lenders so that they're more likely to lend in a space. It's very, very common to use loan guarantees from the federal government in the face of emerging technologies. In fact, the DOE's loan guarantee program was originally started in a very bipartisan way with a lot of Republican leadership to provide loan guarantees for the nuclear industry. So it's a longstanding tool when we're looking at emerging industries. And I think they're in general a very good place for government to be involved because it's not a direct loan program. It's not a direct grant program. What it is the federal government using its backing and the trust it has from the financial sector to back up loans. Overall, the loan guarantee program under the DOE in the Recovery Act had an extraordinarily small default rate. So Lyndra happens to be the default that everyone remembers. The program overall had a default rate lower than almost any private lender in the United States. So it's pretty impressive overall and much lower than we anticipated or than they built in the system they built in to protect the program. So I think that the program overall was pretty impressive. I mean, it allowed for a lot of new companies to grow. It allowed for a lot of private lenders to have more confidence in an emerging market and emerging technologies, which were really new. So the program overall, I think, was a success. Solyndra itself was a manufacturing company for solar, and it was manufacturing at a moment where the solar industry looked like it was going one way, and then it dramatically turned to go another way. That kind of thing happens all the time. It happens all the time in the private sector. It's a natural outcome of folks betting on the market and the market changing. I don't think it was a mistake. I think that we learned a lot from it, and I think that it probably made federal lenders a little more careful about investing in very capital-intensive manufacturing, but I think it was overall a really important program.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think there is this obviously partisan tendency to cherry pick any example that people can find in order to elevate it and give it attention and to prove either an ideological point or a political point in this process. You know, the fact is when you're trying to develop and seed innovation and research and new industries and provide investors with the ability of private investors with the ability to make bets on the future. Inevitably, some research projects come up dry, some investments don't work. But the question is, are you picking this company or that company, but are you making a bet on an industry that is vital to our future and that has enormous potential. And there's no question that trying to sustain a leadership in this area is vital to any projection of the future of the country and of international markets.
I think that's right, and I'll just add one last fact that people often forget that I'm often reminded of by my former colleagues at Center for American Progress. When Herb Allison, who was the former finance chair for Senator John McCain, independently audited the loan guarantee program under Department of Energy after Solyndra, he found that the program overall cost $2 billion less than originally anticipated. So, in fact, that program was a success under an independent analysis. And I think that's the thing to remember is the big picture. Agree with that, Bob, with cherry-picking examples. We can cherry-pick examples all day long on both sides of the aisle, and that what we need to look at is the big picture and the big goal.
Okay, I want to thank you all for being on the call. Again, you can find the report at ourfuture.org/greenrevolution. And if you have any questions, you can reach Kate Gordon at Next Generation in San Francisco or me at the Institute for America's Future here in Washington. Thank you all.